The following talk was given at the Insight Meditation Center in Redwood City, California. Please visit our website at audiodharma.org.
For me to sit here with you this evening, I hope it was nice for you to come together in community to sit in silence. It's a little bit unusual thing for people to do. It was nice to hear the people coming and the rustling and getting settled in the first little bit, and then it was nice to hear, to get quiet and peaceful. And for me, it felt fairly peaceful in here, to have a room full of some 80 people or so, sitting quietly and still. And I appreciated the stillness and the peace that I felt here. And I was a little bit reflecting about how this level of peace, maybe not dramatic, but this level of peace is something which is in short supply for many people in the world. There is plenty of people who don't have the experience of coming in and sitting with a room of, many of you, maybe with strangers even, and feeling safe to close your eyes and sit still and to have it get quiet and still this way. And I wish that, wouldn't it be nice if we could make this kind of peace portable and take it with us and kind of go around and, you know, offer it to other people and other communities. When the Buddha taught, he conveyed two messages. The first message was what he taught. The particular teachings he offered. And the second message is often overlooked. And the second message is that he taught. What he taught and the fact that he taught. And if you look only at what he taught, it's very easy to look at it primarily as individual personal practice. A lot of the teachings are psychological. A lot of them are meditation, tracking your own heart, purifying your heart, bringing your heart to peace. And it's one of the teachings of the Buddha, and down through the ages, one of the great strengths of Buddhism has been this personal aspect of the practice that it offers. And because of this kind of very personal way and individualistic way sometimes that the practice can easily be interpreted, it blinds us to the idea that he did something else. That besides what he taught, he taught. He was, in a certain kind of way, he was in society, he was engaged with the world of his time. And in being engaged, he offered himself. He offered his teachings. He kind of, he was portable. So he walked around northern India and offered what he had to offer. And this idea of that part of what the Buddha's message is to offer ourselves to the world, to offer ourselves our peace, our well-being, our wisdom, our compassion for the welfare of others, is a very important part of much of the Buddhist tradition. And so here we are, portable. Can we take our peace and bring it elsewhere to the places in the world where they need it? Some places need it more than we do, maybe. I was very inspired many years ago when I was a relatively new Zen student. And my Zen teacher said that, he had this little catchy phrase. He said, the Buddha taught the importance of sitting in meditation. Gandhi said it was important where you sit. The idea that you can go sit in the privacy of your room or in a comfortable neighborhood, and that's one thing, certainly beneficial, hopefully. But it's another thing if you go sit in communities where it makes a different message to sit. And, you sit at, so we had sit-ins in the United States long ago. Any of you were part of sit-ins? You know, sit-ins? Yeah, so there were these way of demonstrating a matter where you sat. So right around now, depending how you count the years, is the 50th anniversary of a very famous letter that was written in the United States. It's called The Letter from Birmingham Jail. And it's kind of nice to remember, you know, 50-year anniversary. It's long ago. It seems like long ago, perhaps, 50 years. But, if you're young, it's really, really a long time ago. You know, when someone told me 50 years, when I was 30, 50 years before, I would have kind of like gone to sleep because it just seemed like so far. But it's, you know, not so far. My father-in-law is 85 years old. And it seems like maybe almost because maybe he's coming to the end of his life. I don't know exactly what the reasons are, but he's talking more about his youth. And so I spent the weekend with him, and he wanted to spend a lot of time talking to me. And one of the things he wanted to tell me about was when he was a teenager. And but he was a teenager in the same concentration camp as Anna Frank, same camp that she died in, and he survived. Yeah, that was long ago. And it's very present for him, very alive for him, what he went through. So 50 years ago in our country, there was quite a dramatic civil rights movement that many of us are still kind of benefiting from that this happened. And my own introduction to Buddhism, my interest in Buddhism, was in the wake of the civil rights movement in the United States and also the Vietnam War. I'm of that generation. And there was so much violence. I remember, you know, I moved here from Europe in the early 60s into Los Angeles, and I remember the ash from the riots and Watts landing on our home where I lived. It's kind of a dramatic thing to see. And the Vietnam War. And so this was a kind of formative parts of my life growing up. And so when my first interest in Buddhism was trying to find a way to be part of this world and try to find a way to respond to this world of violence and war that was such a big part of this world of mine. One of the important kind of catalysts for looking at Buddhism the first time was that I was the extreme pacifist in the college dorms, and we were all of draft age, and back then we still had the draft, and so it was possible that any one of us young men, that 18-year-old men in college, by the end of the year, we got this letter saying, you are drafted. Go to Vietnam. Shoot people. So this was not what I wasn't going to do because I was a pacifist. And so we would have these very intense arguments and discussions in the dorms late, way into the night, about what our relationship was to the Vietnam War, to what was going on in the United States. And because I was an extreme pacifist, I had to kind of really work out my understanding, my relationship to this. And for me, being a pacifist was not someone who was, you know, a passive, you know, person, but rather someone who was willing to put their life on the line in demonstration for something they believed in, for injustice. And I was afraid of doing that. I felt like I was not able to do it so well or at all. And so I was looking for something that would help me work through my whatever fear I had or anxiety I had that would prevent me from living my ideals. So I looked around, and somehow, I can't tell you why, but my intuition was that Buddhist practice, what the Buddha taught, the inner technology, inner practices of Buddhism, offered a way to sit with oneself, to look at oneself, and to clarify and work out the fear that I felt, so that I could engage in the world in a way that I thought would be meaningful. So, you know, that's the background that I came to Buddhism from initially, was as an attempt to try to be in the world, not to go away from the world, be in the world better. So now we come to the 50th anniversary of Martin Luther King's famous letter. And Martin Luther King is one of my great heroes. Maybe partly because of his nonviolent stand for social justice and fighting injustice, equality. Buddha, Gandhi, and Martin Luther King. What a great company for heroes. And in 1963, he was invited to Birmingham, where they already started a series of nonviolent protests, the segregation of that town. And according to him and others, it was the most segregated city in the country. And there were bombings of homes of African Americans. People died. The local sheriff was one of the most notorious racists in the country at that time. And the governor of that state was also, you know, at war with not only African Americans, but also with the White House, because he wanted to protest the desegregation of the country back then. And it was a pretty challenging time. I think it's good to remember these things for us, because, you know, we've come a long way in 50 years. The landscape has changed a lot here for most of us, but it's not the same rest of the world. And so Martin Luther King was invited to come in and try to figure out what to do or how to respond, and there was an injunction that if they protested, that they would be arrested. And so they decided they would protest anyway, knowing they'd be arrested. So he left the church on Good Friday and to march down the street, and they were going to go do sit-ins in front of the churches and the places of business in Birmingham, to the places that were segregated. African Americans couldn't go into churches. Isn't that something? It's kind of amazing to me that the churches are closed. And so he didn't go very far down the road, apparently, until they got arrested. They said they were going to arrest him, and so they did. And they put him in jail, and apparently solitary confinement. And apparently there was a newspaper there. And so he was able to write this amazing letter on the margins of the newspaper. And then his lawyer started coming to see him. And slowly, I guess, they tore the edges off the newspaper or something and was able to smuggle the pieces of the newspaper out. And then some assistant of the lawyer in the law firm took the puzzle and pieced it all back together again. And we have this wonderful letter. And the letter was written to a group of clergymen, 12, 13 clergymen in Birmingham, who had written a letter protesting his protesting, saying it was not proper from someone from the outside community to come into Birmingham to, you know, this was a local matter and was not right to come from outside to come in and mess, you know, get nosy, get involved in local problems. And that important to be patient and to negotiate and be part of conversations. And there was other way of doing this, not this kind of extremist approach of sitting down in front of the churches in your suit and tie. My dear fellow clergymen, while confined here in the Birmingham City Jail, I came across your recent statement calling my present activities unwise and untimely. Seldom do I pause to answer criticism of my work and ideas, but since I feel that you are men of genuine good will and that your criticisms are sincerely set forth, I want to try to answer your statements in what I hope will be patient and reasonable terms. Isn't that a great way to begin a letter? You know, he's kind of reaching out in goodwill and praising them and kind of creating a kind of a sense of, you know, goodwill before, you know, you're going to counter them. Somehow the image of him sitting in, I don't know if he sat in jail in his suit and tie, but somehow the image of him sitting in his jail with suit and tie and writing this expressing of goodwill to the people who were upset with him. I think I should indicate why I'm here in Birmingham, since you've been influenced by the view which argues against, quote, outsiders coming in. I, along with several members of my staff, am here because I was invited here. I'm here because I have organizational ties here. More basically, I am in Birmingham because injustice is here. Moreover, I'm cognizant of the interrelatedness of all communities and states. I cannot sit idly by in Atlanta and not be concerned about what happens in Birmingham. Injustice anywhere is a threat to justice everywhere. We are caught in an inescapable network of mutuality, tied in a single garment of destiny. Whatever affects one directly affects all indirectly. Never again can we afford to live in the narrow provincial outside agitator idea. Anyone who lives inside the United States can never be considered an outsider anywhere within its bounds. You deplore the demonstrations taking place in Birmingham, but your statement, I'm sorry to say, fails to express a similar concern for the conditions that brought about the demonstrations. I'm sure that none of you would want to rest content with a superficial kind of social analysis that deals merely with the effects and does not grapple with the underlying causes. It is unfortunate that demonstrations are taking place in Birmingham, but it is even more unfortunate that the city's white power structure left the Negro community with no alternative. In any nonviolent campaign, there are four basic steps. I read this and wondered if I could fit it into the Four Noble Truths. But I was only half successful. In any nonviolent campaign, there are four basic steps. Collection of the facts to determine whether injustice exists. That's the first noble truth. Negotiation. Self-purification. That's a third noble truth. And then direct action. Maybe that's the fourth? Anyway, I thought this was a great list. In any nonviolent campaign, there are four basic steps. Collection of the facts, negotiation, self-purification, and direct action. This idea of self-purification, this seems really, is really, really important. You'll see more why. We have gone through these steps. There can be no gainsaying the fact that racial injustice engulfs this community. Birmingham is probably the most thoroughly segregated city in the United States. Its ugly record of brutality is widely known. Negroes have experienced grossly unjust treatment in the courts. There have been more unsolved bombings of Negro homes and churches in Birmingham than in any other city in the nation. These are hard, brutal facts of the case. On the basis of these conditions, Negro leaders sought to negotiate with the city fathers, but the latter consistently refused to engage in good faith negotiation. Then last September came the opportunity to talk with the leaders of the Birmingham... Oh, skip that. As in so many past experiences, our hopes had been blasted, and the shadow of deep disappointment settled upon us. We had no alternative except to prepare for direct action, whereby we would present our very bodies as a means of laying our case before the conscience of the local and national community. That's something? To present our very bodies as a means of laying our case. So he knew that there was, you know, physical danger, maybe to his life. Mindful of the difficulties involved, we decided to undertake a process of self-purification. We began a series of workshops on nonviolence, and we repeatedly asked ourselves, are you able to accept blows without retaliating? Are you able to endure the ordeal of jail? Isn't that something? To prepare for that? You know, it's one thing to say that you can kind of, you know, let's go out and be nonviolent and protest, but to really know that there's going to be violence against you expected, and then prepare yourself. How do you prepare yourself for that? Have you ever wondered what they did? It's quite something that people want to do that, to have that kind of motivation. It's a lot easier to want to fight. It's a lot easier to get a gun and, you know, feel like you can, you know, shoot. But to do this kind of preparation and that kind of strength of character that comes to then show up and be willing to take blows and not retaliate, that's quite an amazing thing. Not only in terms of courage, and self-purification, but also the kind of wisdom that sees that how important it is to do it. I'll tell you a story I told someone today. And hopefully it's a story which doesn't belittle the magnitude of what happened in Birmingham, but this, you know, the choices we make about how we respond to things. So when I was kind of a bumbling parent with my first kid, and so sometimes I felt it was necessary to use my strong voice, basically say no, strong voice, to get his attention. And so it seemed to be successful. I got, I would use it and behavior would stop. That was great. Very good. Good parenting. I only use it in extreme situations. Until the day I heard my son use that same tone of voice on his younger brother. And then I went, oh my God, what have I done? What do we do? So, prepare yourself, self-purification. You may well ask, why direct action? Why sit-ins, marches, and so forth? Isn't negotiation a better path? You are quite right in calling for negotiation. Indeed, this is the very purpose of direct action. Non-violent direct action seeks to create such a crisis and foster such a tension that a community which has constantly refused to negotiate is forced to confront the issue. It seeks so to dramatize the issue that it can no longer be ignored. My citing the creation of tension as part of the work of the nonviolent resistor may sound rather shocking, but I must confess that I am not afraid of the word tension. I have earnestly opposed violent tension. But there is a type of constructive, non-violent tension which is necessary for growth. Just as Socrates felt that it was necessary to create a tension in the mind so that individuals could rise from the bondage of myths and half-truths to the unfettered realm of creative analysis and objective appraisal, we must see the need for non-violent gadflies to create the kind of tension in society that will help men rise from the dark depths of prejudice and racism to the majestic heights of understanding and brotherhood. This is a good thing for Buddhists to reflect on, because Buddhist cultures, not all of them by any means, but enough of them that I've seen, tend to be conflict avoidant. And and I think that it's a problem. Certainly there's value in not having easy conflict, but to avoid conflict, the creative conflict, to avoid the challenges we have between each other because they're trying to be polite or kind, does a disservice to everyone, I think. And so there is there's a difference here. Makes distinction between violent tension, angry tension, hostile tension, and then the creative tension that helps all of us move forward and clarify what's going on. The purpose of our direct action program is to create a situation so crisis-packed that it will inevitably open the door to negotiation. I therefore concur with you in your call for negotiation. Too long has our beloved Southland been bogged down in a tragic effort to live in monologue rather than dialogue. When I read this, I was kind of touched that he called it our beloved Southland. I myself had a lot of prejudice against the South growing up. I grew up in California, right? And it was like, how could they do those things? Those people, those white people. I just felt like an awful place. It was kind of in my mind. I apologize if any of you are from the South, but I had this kind of strong kind of prejudice of my own. And then to read Martin Luther King's in our beloved Southland. One of the basic points in your statement is that the action that I and my associates have taken in Birmingham is untimely. The replies to that. My friends, I must say that that we have not made a single gain with our civil rights without determined legal and nonviolent pressure. Lamentably, it is an historical fact that privileged groups seldom give up their privileges voluntarily. Individuals may see the moral light and voluntarily give up their unjust posture, but, as Reinhold Niebuhr has reminded us, groups tend to be more immoral than individuals. We know through painful experience that freedom is never voluntarily given by the oppressor. It must be demanded by the oppressed. Frankly, I have not yet to engage in a direct action campaign that was well timed. Quote. In the view of those who have not suffered unduly from the disease of segregation. For years now I've heard the word wait. It rings in the ears of every Negro with piercing familiarity. This wait has almost always meant never. We have come to see with one of our distinguished jurists that, quote, justice too long delayed is justice denied. We have waited for more than 340 years for our constitutional and God-given rights. The nations of Asia and Africa are moving with jet-like speed toward gaining political independence, but we stiff creep at horse and buggy pace towards gaining a cup of coffee at a lunch counter. Perhaps it's easy for those who have never felt the stinging bark of segregation to say, wait. But when you have seen vicious mobs lynch your mothers and fathers at will and drown your sisters and brothers at whim, when you have seen hate-filled policemen curse, kick, and even kill your black brothers and sisters, when you see the vast majority of your 20 million Negro brothers smothering an airtight cage of poverty in the midst of an affluent society, when you suddenly find your tongue twisted and your speech stammering as you seek to explain to your six-year-old daughter why she can't go to the public amusement park that had just been advertised on television, and see tears welling up in her eyes when she's told that Funtown is closed to colored children, and see ominous clouds of inferiority beginning to form in her little mental sky, and see her beginning to distort her personality by developing an unconscious bitterness towards white people. When you have to concoct an answer for a five-year-old son who is asking, Daddy, why do white people treat colored people so mean? When you take a cross-country drive and find it necessary to sleep night after night in uncomfortable corners of your automobile because no motel will accept you. When you are humiliated day in and day out by a nagging sign reading white and colored. Then he goes on I hope you are able to ace the distinction I'm trying to point out. In no sense do I advocate evading or defying the law, as would the rabid segregationists. That would lead to anarchy. One who breaks an unjust law must do so openly, lovingly, and with a willingness to accept the penalty. Isn't this interesting? So he is going to protest and break the law in his nonviolent protest. And he says you need to do it openly and lovingly. I submit that an individual who breaks a law that conscience tells him is unjust and who willingly accepts the penalty of imprisonment in order to arouse the conscience of the community over its injustice is in reality expressing the highest respect for law. It goes on and on with analysis of just and unjust laws. You speak of our activity in Birmingham as extreme. At first, I was rather disappointed that fellow clergymen would see my nonviolent efforts as those of an extremist. I began thinking about the fact that that I stand in the middle of two opposing forces in the Negro community. One is a force of complacency, made up in part of the Negroes who, as a result of long years of oppression, are so drained of self-respect and a sense of somebody-ness that they have adjusted to segregation, and in part of a few middle-class Negroes who, because of a degree of academic and economic security, and because in some ways they profit by segregation, have become insensitive to the problems of the masses. The other force is one of bitterness and hatred, and it comes perilously close to advocating violence. It is expressed in various black nationalist groups that are springing up around the nation, the largest and best known being Alaya Muhammad's Muslim movement. Nourished by the Negro's frustration over the continued existence of racial discrimination, this movement is made up of people who have lost faith in America, who have absolutely repudiated Christianity, and who have concluded that the white man is an incorrigible devil. I have tried to stand between these two forces, saying that we need to emulate neither the do-nothingism of the complacent nor the hatred and despair of the black nationalist, for there is a more excellent way of love and nonviolent protest. I wish to commend the Negro sit-iners and demonstrators of Birmingham for their sublime courage, their willingness to suffer, and their amazing discipline in the midst of great provocation. One day the South will recognize its real heroes. They will be the James Merediths with a noble sense of purpose that enables them to face jeering and hostile mobs and with the agonizing loneliness that characterizes the life of the pioneer. And he goes on, he says, in the end, if I've said, there's a long letter, this is only little excerpts from it. If I've said anything in this letter that overstates the truth and indicates an unreasonable impatience, I beg you to forgive me. Isn't that nice too? If I've said anything that understates the truth and indicates my having patience that allows me to settle for anything less than brotherhood, I beg God to forgive me. So I think here he's also offering his willingness to talk and to look at his own faults and, you know, be in negotiation, be in discussion. I hope this letter finds you strong in faith. I also hope that circumstances will soon make it possible for me to meet each of you, not as an integrationist or a civil rights leader, but as a fellow clergyman and a Christian brother. Let us all hope that the dark clouds of racial prejudice will soon pass away and the deep fog of misunderstanding will be lifted from our fear-drenched communities. And in some not too distant tomorrow, the radiant stars of love and brotherhood will shine over our great nation with all their scintillating beauty. Yours for the cause of peace, Martin Luther King, Jr. So that was a long thing to read. I hope it was okay. But I thought it was, I offer it to you not just as a memory of what happened here 50 years ago and the significance and the wisdom of this man, what he had to offer, but also as an expression of the kind of Dharma practice or practice of liberation that I hope that Buddhist practice is about as well. It's possible to trace a little bit the teachings of Martin Luther King's teachings on nonviolence through Gandhi back into the ancient Dharmic roots of India, to Buddhism and Jainism and other places where they had the teachings of nonviolence. Gandhi himself was inspired by that long history in India, and Martin Luther King was inspired by him. So what is our practice for? What is our life for? And each person's going to answer that for themselves, and there's not a right or wrong answer. But I believe that the practice of sitting and meditation, the ability to discover peace, the ability to resolve the tensions and divisions within ourselves, is a phenomenal thing to offer to our wider community. Prepares us, does a self work of self-purification that it prepares us to be able to respond to our neighbors, our communities in important ways. And I think it's a little bit of a pity, it's like a terribly underused resources, if Buddhist practitioners do all this work of self-purification and then just sit around and don't use it. So there's many ways of using it, of course. It doesn't have to look like what Martin Luther King did. But I would like to adopt Martin Luther King as one of the patron saints of Buddhism, and to be there in the pantheon of Buddhist saints, Buddhist heroes, to challenge us to consider what our practice is about, what our lives are about, and what the potential is for what we can do with this practice and the peace that we can offer our world. So I hope that probably you didn't expect this tonight. So I hope it was okay. But, you know, the risk for all of us is that when I come down here, I'll talk about what's on my heart. So is that enough? Or does anybody want to make any comments or questions? Yes, please. Or maybe you can use the mic, please. He has a T-shirt that says freedom on it.
It says freedom to roam.
Uh-huh.
It's, yeah, okay, that's the whole thing about that. But I just wanted to say that, I want to say thank you for bringing that. Last time I heard that, it's just very emotional for me right now, because last time I heard that, that was read to me by my grandmother when I was 16. She got that. She led protests and movements in Palo Alto to allow black people to go to like just Rinconada Park, which they couldn't back then. And she took me to those protests when I was very young. And when this letter was written and came out, she came to our high school, Palo Alto High School, and she read that letter aloud to our history class.
Wow.
She asked to read this. And she always, you know, she directly taught me at that time that she's a practicing Catholic, and she said that all this religion and everything you're doing is so that you can be touched by the divine, so that you'll know the divine and you can show the next person they too are divine. And until all people are equal, then no one is equal, no one is free. And she said to me then, she had long talks with me, she would tell me, she says, someday you will be asked to go and kill someone and they will tell you it's for your freedom. And that did come to pass. And I was like you. I was not going to go do that. And led protests here in town and at Stanford, etc., to stop and, you know, burn your draft card, etc. We're not going to do this. This is not how we're going to solve our problems. And when that occurred, she came with me to Stanford, laid one of those protests and sat where we burned our draft cards. And this, you know, at that time, about a 7-year-old grandmother sat with me, and she goes, that's right. You have to be able, you have to be willing to stand firm and take the consequences of your actions. And so I just, that was just so moving. I just, to hear that tonight, it's brought back a lot for me. And so, just thank you. And
thank you for telling us. I appreciate it a lot. And it brought it home, you know, it brought it home right here to our community. Made it local, not just the South. Right. Straight back in the back.
I was on the San Mateo coast in, by Davenport yesterday, stopped for a cup of coffee, and they had a big picture of Cesar Chavez. And we were told that that was Cesar Chavez Day.
Yeah.
It was March 31st. And it was, I was thinking of that when you were reading that he was, again, was another person who followed that. nonviolence.
Yeah, I thought of that too when I was thinking about reading this. Was it's, you know, Cesar Chavez is being remembered these days also, yesterday. And he also, you know, has a local connection here. He was kind of discovered in a way, or kind of encouraged. He apparently was a very shy young man here in Los Altos Hills by the people who owned what now called Hidden Villa, what they called the Duveneks. Okay. Oh yes, more? One more?
I'm from the South, from the western edge of the South, but it's still the South. And I'm old enough to remember the whites and the colored signs segregating in downtown department stores, the water fountains and the bathrooms and movie theaters and so forth. But I do feel quite saddened every time I hear someone from California expressing something critical or down-putting of Texas South in general, because I go back about once a year to visit family, and I am always strongly struck by, even though the fact that almost everyone there votes differently from almost everyone in this room, I mean, complete opposite, yet the people there are incredibly generous. They have been. They were my dad's neighbors who didn't know him at all, helped him a lot, and now they're doing the same for different people. But incredibly generous to my mother, who they don't know or didn't at first, just because she needs help.
Travel through the South in early 70s, and I had this prejudice about the South because of what I, you know, from a distance, and I was stunned by how friendly many of the white people were that I met. I had no idea, you know, I wasn't expecting it. But I met other white people too that, you know, I felt lucky to get out alive. Literally, I think there was one situation where I was traveling with this guy who was a comedian, natural comedian, and because of his amazing capacity for comedy, got us out of what was certainly going to be violence, because I was a hippie, and hippies didn't go very well with rednecks, and so the juxtaposition of these very friendly people and this capacity for racism was quite an interesting kind of mix. How do they work together? What's the psychology of that? Is something to consider.
And I think it's changed some.
Oh yeah,
since then.
Oh, it's changed a lot. The world, the country's changed a lot, but it could change some more. Great. Thank you all very much for being willing to listen to this.